Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The president of the United States of America continued his racist bashing of four Democratic congresswomen of color today. In tweets this morning, he called them, quote, anti-USA, pro-terrorist. And he added, quote, if you hate our country or if you are not happy here, you can leave. Until the president lashed out first on Sunday, the story had been the damaging feud between Democrats, with some of those same congresswomen accusing some of their fellow Democrats, including African-Americans and Native Americans, of supporting systemic racism by voting for an emergency border aid package. Even in the drinking from the fire hose feel that American politics has had for the past couple of years, this again feels like one of those moments where we have to talk about who we really are and what kind of nation we want to be. So this hour on Point, race and politics in America now. And I really want you to join us. What's been going through your mind these past couple of weeks as Democrats accused each other of racism and then as the president began with his go back language? The president says he's just saying what some people think. What's your response to that, to how his party is handling this? What do you want to see your elected officials do now, and what kind of nation do you want to live in? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll join first today from Washington by Representative William Lacey Clay. He's a 10-term congressman serving Missouri's 1st District, which includes St. Louis. He's the senior Democrat from Missouri. He's the chairman of the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Housing, Community Development, and Insurance, and a senior member of the House Oversight Committee. He's also a member of the Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus. Representative William Lacey Clay, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on today, and it's always great to be back on NPR, and I want to give a shout-out to KWMU St. Louis, my excellent NPR station in St. Louis.
On any shout-out for one of our fantastic member stations is always worth it, Congressman Clay. So let's get right down to it. I want to talk to you both about the president and about your fellow Democrats, but first, about the president. What is your response to his continued bashing of these congresswomen of color?
Well, first of all, President Trump is a racist. It's deep in his DNA. He's always embraced hate and division, first for profits and then for votes. And now he's facing a reelection with a shrinking base. And he needs to stoke the fires of hate to bring out his vote. And that's hateful. That's un-American, and he and his Republican enablers should be ashamed. And today, I will join with Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats to hold him accountable.
Well, you know, the president has also said that he's just saying what some people think, and he's probably not wrong about that. And in fact, not all that many Republicans have condemned the president yet. What's your response to that?
Well, these were duly elected members of Congress that he was referencing, who were elected by the majority of voters in each of their districts. They happened to be qualified citizens and Americans. And so he's wrong, he's off base, and there's no place in American politics for that kind of discourse.
So just to make one thing clear, of course, this latest moment that we're in was kicked off by some tweets from Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief of staff, Saikat Chakrabarty. And I am not related to him. There's no relation between me and him. And he had accused certain members of Congress of Democrats of systemic racism for votes that they took on that emergency aid bill for border funding. Now, for a while, Democrats had a very intense internecine battle about that. And here comes the president, in a way, proving the systemic racism is real. I mean, has he, by virtue of the tweets he's put out and what he said, has he, in a sense, offered to Democrats a lifeline out of their own circular firing squad?
I don't think it's that. I mean, I did not vote for the package because I didn't think it went far enough in addressing the catastrophe that's been brought on by this administration, by the point people, by the one at the top, the president, as well as Stephen Miller, who have instituted this policy and carried it out. And so that was my reason for not voting for the package. And I think that we have a united caucus and being led by an excellent team of leaders, starting with Speaker Pelosi and the entire leadership team. And as long as we stay united, as Speaker Pelosi said, that will signify our strength. And we have to remain united in order to remain in the majority. And when you look at this government today, we are only one wing of a branch that Democrats control. And we have to work towards maintaining that control in the House, as well as looking at winning the Senate and the presidency.
But are Democrats united? Perhaps in their opposition to the president. But, I mean, didn't you just say in recent days that you were frustrated with people like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for, quote, having used the race card?
Well, yes, and my comments in The Hill and The Washington Post were absolutely correct, and they were overwhelmingly appreciated by the members of the House Democratic Caucus. And I have nothing against any member of the House freshman class. In fact, I've worked with them to co-sponsor legislation and to help them with their priorities. In fact, I consider them all to be talented young members that are essential to our caucus. But sometimes they have to be schooled, they have to be guided back to reality, and they have to understand that throwing a tantrum and using the word racism loosely is an insult to generations of brave people who have faced the full evils of racism and sacrificed so much to overcome it. And the events since Friday have proven me correct. When you don't get your way on a bill, you don't accuse our leadership of racism, especially when we have the racist in chief in the White House.
So, Congressman Clay, help us understand this moment here now, because, you know, as a deeply experienced servant to the people in your district and to the country, as an African-American man, like all the things that you just said, from your compassionate criticism of your fellow Democrats, your young Democrats, to the demonstration that the president of the United States has made about the persistent existence of racism in this country.
Sure.
These are all part of a continuum. I mean, how do we move forward here?
Okay, here's how I think we move forward. First of all, the almost complete lack of criticism from congressional Republicans is astonishing. And then they will have to go on record today when we vote on this resolution. I don't think they any longer have a moral compass, and they are complicit in the horrible damage that Donald Trump is inflicting on our democracy. But when we talk about this moment in American history, I would hope that this moment will evoke a frank and honest national conversation that moves the collective conscience of this nation to grapple with race and racism in our society and its corrosive and debilitating impact it has had on people of color throughout our nation's history, and cause us to work for improving race relations as a compassionate people, while at the same time rejecting the hate espoused by this president and a small minority of Americans.
Well, Representative William Lacy Clay, 10-term congressman serving Missouri's 1st District, the senior Democrat from Missouri, a member of the Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus as well. Congressman Clay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a blessed day.
I should note that we did put out requests to all four members of the so-called squad, the congresswomen of color, including Representatives Presley, Talib, Omar, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They all declined our invitation, but they have given a press conference just yesterday afternoon to respond to the president's call for them to, quote, go back where they came from. Here is Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Weak minds and leaders challenge loyalty to our country in order to avoid challenging and debating the policy. This president does not know how to make the argument that Americans do not deserve health care. He does not know how to defend his policies. So what he does is attack us personally. And that is what this is all about.
That's Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just yesterday. Well, joining us now is Peniel Joseph. He's a professor at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the founding director of the LBJ's School Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, joining us from Austin, Texas. Professor Joseph, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
So give us your read of this moment and what the past several days have said about America, race, and politics today.
Well, I think throughout the Trump presidency, we've seen that race and really racism and the politics of racial identity are at the core of what it means to be American. Now, sometimes this can be positive. When we think about the heroic period of the civil rights movement, we think about presidents like John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. There was an attempt to say that race was at the core of who we are, but racial justice needed to be part of the consensus of what made America a great nation, a multicultural and multiracial nation. So there's really this historic push-pull. On one level, we have presidents like Abraham Lincoln and activists like Frederick Douglass or Sojourner Truth or Harriet Tubman or Ida B. Wells, who are saying that racial justice is at the core of who we are. And whether you're black or brown or Native American, you are part of this national American family. But then we also have pushback, and we have certain presidents like a President Andrew Johnson or even a President Woodrow Wilson who really do embrace this philosophy of sort of white nationalism.
Well, stand by for just a second, Professor Joseph. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about race, racism, and American politics now, and we want to hear from you what has been going through your mind these past couple of days as Democrats accused each other of supporting systemic racism for voting on an emergency aid bill for the border. And then what's your reaction to the president saying he's just saying what some people think when he says to those same congresswomen to go back, quote, go back where they came from? What is your response to that? And what kind of nation do you want to live in now? What do you want to see our elected officials do now to respond to this moment? Let's listen to a little bit of what the president said in support of his own tweets at the end of his third annual, quote, Made in America product showcase just yesterday. The president stood by his criticism of the so-called squad, the four congresswomen of color that he has been bashing relentlessly on Twitter.
As far as I'm concerned, if you hate our country, if you're not happy here, you can leave. And that's what I say all the time. That's what I said in a tweet, which I guess some people think is controversial. A lot of people love it, by the way. A lot of people love it. But if you're not happy in the U.S., if you're complaining all the time, very simply, you can leave. You can leave right now.
That's the president yesterday. We're joined today by Peniel Joseph. He's a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin and also founding director of the school's Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. And Professor Joseph, just before the break, I wanted to let you continue the thought that you were making before the break about this push-pull in American history coming out of the White House about the inclusion of all Americans and this idea of what makes this nation. So is this one of those push moments here with what the president has been saying?
Well, yeah, and I think this connects to the Democratic debate. I won't even call it an internecine battle, but the debate that's happening within the party over what do we mean by citizenship and racial justice. If we go back to 1965 and the Hart-Celler Act, which was passed by Lyndon Johnson, but also the Voting Rights Act, these are acts that made multiracialism and racial justice at the core of a new American consensus about what did citizenship, freedom, and liberty mean. Even though there was that consensus legally and legislatively, and this is connected to the Brown Supreme Court desegregation case too, and these are all this legislation that's passed during the heroic period of the civil rights movement, there was pushback among white Americans, both at the local, regional, and national level. And this brings me to Joe Biden. So when Joe Biden, who's now running for president, when he did not support busing, busing was just a euphemism for racial integration. I think Biden probably on principle supports racial integration, but politically in the early 70s, he couldn't support racial integration and be a multi-term senator from Delaware, the state of Delaware. So what's interesting about what Trump has done is that he's really managed to exploit cleavages within the Republican and the Democratic Party that pivot on race and racial justice. And racial justice in terms of both anti-Black racism, but also race in a more general way when we think about immigration and brown people and Black people and Spanish speakers who are coming in, because the president and white nationalists, they have no problem with immigration from Scandinavia. And the president has even said that, right? Off the record, not only did he call African and third world countries a slur, but he said, you know, why aren't we getting more people from Sweden and places
Norway,
like that,
right?
And Norway. So what's so interesting about this current moment, even the debate within the Democratic Party, that debate centers on race, because after the 2016 election, all we heard was, why doesn't the Democratic Party reach out to working class whites? There was a racial assumption in that because the Democratic Party's best voters are Black women and men, but especially Black women. Mm. So instead of having a million op-ed pieces about what the Democratic Party needed to do in 2018 and 2020 to get Black women to vote for them in droves so they could win and they could rule, all we heard was, how can the party recapture white male and female voters who voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump? And I think that's the push, that's the debate you're seeing within the party.
Well, Professor Joseph, stand by, because I want to bring into the conversation Rochelle Riley. She's joining us from Detroit, Michigan. She's director of arts and culture for the city of Detroit, also a columnist who has covered race and politics in Detroit for the past 20 years. She's the author of the forthcoming book for young readers titled That They Lived, 20 African Americans Who Changed the World. Rochelle Riley, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So Professor Joseph has said a lot, and I want you to respond to some of what he said. But first of all, just give us your big picture take, as I began with the professor as well, on this moment now. What is it saying about where America is regarding how it talks about race, even, you know, between Democrats, first of all, and also as how the president talks about race? I mean, how do you respond to the complexity of this moment?
Well, we are at a true crossroads right now, and our two paths are either to go down the path that Donald Trump has paved, that sees race through a political lens that is divisive and only will deal with debate and argument, or the conversation that we should have been having for hundreds of years about what to do post-enslavement. I think that our biggest problem is Donald Trump owns the media, not by property deed, but by influence. So he is now forcing this conversation to be about his attack on politicians when it wasn't an attack on politicians. It was an attack on four American women. So when he tells them to go back where they came from an America that existed before he was president. And I think a lot of people want to go back there.
Hmm. And so tell us what you think then about what Peniel Joseph was talking about the president managing to exploit cleavages, not just in the Republican Party, but in the Democratic Party as well, on the whole concept of what racial justice should be in America.
Well, again, he has made it a political discussion, and the professor is exactly right. What you have is people talking about how far the Democratic Party can go and not feel like it's leaving some people behind. So right now you have two Democratic parties, the one that still pretends like we're in a sane America and the one that's trying to make change. And you have one united GOP, and I talked to a local Republican leader who said Donald Trump is a necessary evil, but he's necessary for us to stay in power. So they will be united, even if they quietly, like Mitt Romney, say, oh, that wasn't a good thing. Or, you know, if some of them are so outraged that they leave the party, like Congressman Amash who here in Michigan, there are divisions everywhere.
Mm. Well, let's take a couple of calls here. James is calling from Dayton, Ohio. James, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the fact that, systemic racism is very real. It's very apparent here in Dayton, Ohio, for a lot of reasons. And I think that the president's comments highlight that in that they are just so absurd. He is an immigrant from an immigrant family himself, and to call out others who are from a different place because they're in, and the fact that their color of their skin is different just highlights that. I mean, European immigration apparently is okay. But, we seek to exclude others. That's the message that he's giving. It's just hypocritical.
Right. James, thank you for your call. Professor Joseph, James's comment makes me think that also there's this question of race and the perception of loyalty to the idea of America, right? I mean, that we have a history where, very passionate, proud citizens of this country, because of the color of their skin, when they dare to call for something better or to criticize this nation, they have been historically conceived as disloyal to the nation.
No, that's exactly right. Black people and people of color in many ways have loved America the longest and been valued the least by the nation state. And our loyalty is always questioned. We've served in every single war or conflict that this country has ever fought. And really, when you have a love and a thirst for justice and you're trying to push a republic or a nation state or a democracy for more justice, your loyalty should never be questioned. And we only question that loyalty out of fear, right, and out of panic. So this idea that these women who are three of whom are born in America are somehow disloyal and should come back to where they came from. They're from here. They are us. And this idea that because you're challenging racism or you're challenging sexism or you're challenging any kind of inequality, that means somehow you don't love the country. It really feeds into Trump's version of white nationalism, distorts a civic nationalism, this idea of a civic religion of America as this multicultural, multiracial, liberty surest guardian across the world, and transposes that and transfers that onto white, southern, NASCAR, these stereotypes and these cliches, male, heterosexual. And that's exactly what the country is not becoming. The country is becoming more diverse, both politically, religiously, ethnically, in terms of sexual orientation, ideologically, and we're seeing a pushback against that.
Well, so I would say that without a doubt, the president's use of racially charged language is long and deep. But I'm going to keep coming back to this because I have to say I really don't understand it, and I'd love your thoughts on this. And Rochelle Riley, let me start with you regarding how this latest maelstrom began when senior members of a congresswoman's staff, a Democratic congresswoman's staff, accuses fellow Democrats of supporting institutional racism or behaving like Southern segregationists from the 40s because of a vote they took. I mean, I think there are many Americans out there who say that is throwing a racist accusation out there too quickly. And it contributes to the challenge that we have about reckoning with racism accurately or honestly now. What's your response to that?
Well, I can tell you two things. One is I'm glad that the professor brought up a little bit of history, because everything in America that has been made better has been made better out of criticism and a need for change. The country was founded on a need for change, my God, where people decided they needed to go someplace else because they didn't feel comfortable where they were. So as we continue to amend the Constitution and change laws to be better, the idea that someone else wants to dictate when you are upset or how much you are upset by something, you know, racism for people who are not people of color is this thing that they look at from a distance. But racism for those of us of color is like this low buzz in the background, as Shonda Rhimes' character said in a television show once. It's always there. So sometimes when it erupts, it's because it's necessary. It's not because, well, you know, it's too old to talk about, or it's not big enough to make a big deal about. Racism is racism is racism. And when the entire country depends on your leader in chief to keep that at bay, to try and get people to a different place, and he's not willing to go, and he wants to take all of the people who aren't willing to go with him, then that is a real, real problem for America. Mm. I don't think you can have too many concerns raised about something that has been so systemic that it has literally harmed generations of people.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Gary, who's calling from Minot, North Dakota. Gary, you're on the air.
Thank you. You know, it's kind of funny that Trump makes a statement, but yet they don't look at going back to their district and straighten up. They want to change it to another country instead of – they want to make it a racial deal. Instead of doing what the American people ask, they're not even doing their job.
How is
you
it?
Know, if you go back and look at them and look at their district, they haven't done much. What have they done for the American people? Nothing.
So what's the point you're trying to make, Gary?
Well, they're trying to make it a racial deal and try to turn it on Trump when they don't even look at themselves. It's hypocritical of a person to not look at their own district where they're coming from and see all the garbage and everything else that's going on there. They haven't even helped their own neighbors. They don't help the American people. They're only out for themselves to put money in their own pocket.
How do you know that? How do you know that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez hasn't helped her district, or Ayanna Pressley hasn't helped her district? How do you know that?
Go ahead and look at the area. Look at the slums and stuff. What have they gotten?
Gary, just look. I welcome all voices and criticisms here, but I happen to live in or very next door to one of the districts that you're talking about, and it's not a slum. I've seen it. I've walked in the neighborhoods. I know people who live there. It's not a slum.
Okay. Have you been in Minnesota?
Have you been
in the area where that gal come from?
Not recently.
Go over there and look and see how it's changed in the last 5 years.
All right, Gary. Well, thank you so much for your call. So, Rochelle Riley, you're there in Detroit, another place represented by one of these congresswomen. What's your response to what Gary said?
Well, I can tell you with all due respect to anyone who supports Donald Trump so that they repeat everything that he says, I can guarantee you that very few of them have bothered to check anything that he says. And there's no need to argue with someone who's decided that their loyalty is such that they are going to parrot what is sometimes nonsense. I think that it's a shame that there are people who are trying to make real change and they're being diffused and attacked literally because of something that has nothing to do with what they're doing. Donald Trump isn't attacking these women because of work that they are doing or not doing in their districts. He's attacking them because they disagree with him, because they raise questions about policies that he is literally either demanding or suggesting without any possibility of their being done. And the worst part is we allow him to dictate how we talk about this. You know, he uses a term that I never say out loud, but I'll say it once just for the sake of clarity, fake news. It is a horrible, horrible, decremental phrase that no media outlet should use. But instead, we allow him to say it all day long. We print it in newspapers all day long. People have adopted it, which means he's allowing us to commit suicide in front of him. He's a very powerful communicator with no message. And yet no one has ever asked him to go back to Germany, not when he was racist the first time, not when he was racist the second time, and not when he was racist this week.
Right. Well, Peniel Joseph, we have a minute to go before we have to take a quick break here. And I want to say that I actually appreciate Gary calling in and giving us his honest opinion, because I don't think he's alone. He's not alone.
No.
So respond to what he said, where he says it's these congresswomen who have made it about race, because even the president also tweeted that same thing. He said when the congresswomen make it, accuse others of racism, quote, including Nancy Pelosi, they are the source of the problem. What's your response to that?
Well, no, I mean, identifying racial injustice and institutional racism does not make you a racist, but that is part of the narrative that we have now, the narratives of political correctness and narratives that, you know, like of fake news, where we say that if you identify a racial injustice and you bring up the racial disparities that happen, whether it's in the criminal justice system or employment or in any aspect of American life, you yourself are a racist. And that's untrue. And I think a person like that caller, it would be great to have a conversation with that person where you show them facts, but you also show them those communities that he might think of as sort of stereotypical ghettos or slums, which was a popular word in the 1960s, but that are really communities of color, segregated communities because of public policy and our politics, but communities where there are good people who he could actually meet and maybe empathize with.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about race, racism, and American politics today. Some Republican members of Congress have been speaking out about the latest controversy over the president's tweets and the statements of Democratic congresswomen. Republican Representative Liz Cheney today just said in her reference to the outcry over the president's tweets that, quote, our opposition to our socialist colleagues has absolutely nothing to do with their gender, with their religion, or with their race. It has to do with the content of their policies. That's from GOP Representative Liz Cheney just this morning. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Lisa, who's calling from New Orleans. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to bring up, so I recently was in Montgomery, Alabama, to avoid the storm in New Orleans, and I was so, you know, proud of that city, of Montgomery, because the whole theme throughout the city is we've had such a gut-wrenching racial history in the city. It was the heart of the slave trade, and, you know, instead of turning a blind eye on it, they have museums and monuments all over the city just dedicated to the hard work in the civil rights movement by people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. And it really, you know, was striking to hear Trump's words after being in a city that is just talking like so based on recognizing our history and not reliving it. And to have him saying things that are very comparable to things like the Back to Africa movement, which was in contrast with the abolitionist movement, towards the end of slavery. And, you know, it's really horrible to see us reliving this. After looking at places in our country that are working so hard to, you know, repent for all of the injustice that have gone on.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your call. Professor Joseph, I know I've got to let you go here in a minute, but I just wanted to give you one a chance to respond to what Lisa says. Again, looking through the lens of American history.
Well, yeah, I think those are great points. And I think what we're all facing is the fact that the narrative of the civil rights movement that we have is that Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., and then Barack Obama solved this nation's problem of both racial injustice and white supremacy. That is not true. That is a mythology. That is a lie. And what we're seeing is that even though there were great victories that have produced the Kamala Harrises, that have produced the Ayanna Pressleys and Barack and Michelle Obama, at the quotidian level, at the everyday level, African Americans, Latinos, people of color, Native Americans, suffer from institutional discrimination, from racial violence, from state-sanctioned violence at every significant social economic level in the United States. And they suffer this at the local level, at the regional level, at the state level, and nationally. And so the only way we can come to this national, not just conversation about race, but really a public policy transformation, is to admit where we've succeeded, but also admit where we've failed. And we've failed so many children, so many people who are incarcerated, so many even public officials, that until we can come to terms with that failure, we will not be able to turn the corner. And Trump is besides the point. He's sort of background noise to this idea of white supremacy and racial injustice. Turn the corner where we actually treat black people and people of color as human beings, both at the institutional level, but also the neighborhood level. And that means talking about not just things like reparations, but racial integration and ending the segregation of American public schools and American neighborhoods once and for all.
Professor Joseph, if I might say, I am doing my best to be on attack of objectivity and openness here. But it's also hard not to feel sorrowful at this moment. It's kind of it's the emotional state of mind that I'm trying to push aside as I do my job as a journalist here. But do I hear a same sense of sorrow in your voice?
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm the father of three, and I think that I always have to hold on to optimism because of being a father. But no, this is a sad time. But I'm always optimistic because of one, people like yourself and Rochelle, but the historical figures that we've had, like Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, so many black women and men who and Latino women and men who've really struggled against all these odds, and they do believe in this country and they do love this country in spite of the criticism, and they love their children and they love everyone's children, and what they want is a better and more just society for all. And I think we need that empathy. I think Martin Luther King Jr. talked about a moral revolution in his Birmingham letter from his letter from Birmingham jail. And so we need to love each other, but we need to be honest with each other, and we need to think of Ella Baker said, until a black child is thought of as well as a white child, we who believe in freedom would not be, would not rest.
Yeah.
And so we still don't think of black lives and people of color's lives as mattering as much as whites, even though they do and they should.
Well, Professor Peniel Joseph is the founding director of the LBJ School of Public School Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Joseph, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
All right, Rochelle, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but let's first go back to the phones. Ken is calling from Buffalo, New York. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. I'm sorry, I don't know your guest name, but hello.
Rochelle Riley, but go ahead, Ken.
My comment was Rochelle's comment about how Trump is controlling the narrative is right. And I think part of the problem, at least for as a progressive, as a Democrat, is broadly, if you look in the past, the civil rights movement, basically the message was, and this is simplistic, that minorities wanted a part of the American dream. And that's easy to understand, I think, for a lot of people. Where today, when we talk about equality, our equity, and those are really dense terms. And I think talking with people I know, I don't even get the same answer from a small group of people about what those mean.
Yeah. Well, Ken, I'm going to take it back from you here because I have the perfect person to help answer that point or that question. So, Ken, thank you for your call. And joining us now from Bethesda, Maryland, is E.J. Dionne. He's columnist for The Washington Post, professor of government at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His most recent column in The Washington Post on Sunday was headlined, "The Democrats Are Fighting Each Other When They Should Be Fighting Trump." And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. E.J. Dionne, welcome to the program.
Always good to be with you. Thanks.
And thanks for your patience, E.J. There's just a lot to wade through here, so I really appreciate you being with us. First of all, respond to what you heard the caller saying, in that he believes that the Democrats as a party bear a lot to blame here because they don't have a message that's anything other than anti-Donald Trump.
Well, I think part of that is a problem with the fact that they have passed about 100 bills, including, you know, major reform of the political system and a lot of bills to advance social justice in various ways that are getting no traction in the Senate. And I think that is what explains some of the frustration you're seeing in the party. I like to say that if power can corrupt, powerlessness is particularly frustrating. And I think a lot of this back and forth in the party is that they don't have the power yet. They got one House of Congress, half of the legislative branch of the government, and there's obviously a limit on what they can do and a limit on the extent to which it's penetrating to the country. And so when you see the kind of division and frustration you've seen in the party over the last few weeks, it's not surprising. I think that we might see, because of these truly wretched racist comments of President Bush, a certain coming back together in the party. My column was about, hey, guys, you don't have all the power you need right now. Your first job is to oppose and defeat Bush. And then there is a chance to have some of these arguments about the right way forward later on.
Yeah, EJ, let me hear. You said President Bush twice. You meant President Trump.
Sorry. God, that's terrible. I appreciate the correction. Right. I meant President Trump. That is the priority here.
Well, so let me ask you then about the question a little bit more about the Democrats fighting each other part, because, you know, I'm seeing here that, first of all, a couple of days ago, Speaker Pelosi said she felt compelled to speak out because she had Democratic staffers coming to her who were emotional and felt offended by what Saikat Chakrabarty, again, the chief of staff for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, had tweeted. I mean, there apparently at one time he had singled out Representative Charisse Davis, from Kansas, and also a Native American. And so the House Democrats even felt that, as a group, they used their Twitter account to say, quote, "Who is this guy and why is he explicitly singling out a Native American woman of color?" I mean, so inside the Democratic Party themselves, how are they handling this moment about race, the truth about race, and how accusation of racism are accusations are made?
Well, you know, during the 2018 campaign, I covered two remarkable women who got elected to Congress. One was Ayanna Pressley in Boston, and I covered her primary, and the other was Abigail Spanberger. Ayanna Pressley is obviously one of the four singled out by President Trump. Abigail Spanberger is from a very Republican district that she took away from a Tea Party member of Congress. And after the Democrats won, I wrote a story saying that in order to preserve this majority, these two wings of the party are going to have to learn to respect each other and learn how to work together. And I added the sentence, "So I want Ayanna Pressley and Abigail Spanberger to become best friends." And it was a lovely thing that happened. They happened to be at a meeting when that column posted, and they sent out a picture of the two of them hugging. Those are the two wings of the Democratic Party that have to work together. And I think what Pelosi was responding to was frustration among some of those many Democrats who took Republican seats at being attacked for what they deeply believe, I think with reason, for being attacked for what they're not. Mm-hmm. These are broadly progressive people who are obviously more moderate. And I think, you know, a congresswoman like Ayanna Pressley understands that very well. And so I think Pelosi felt some obligation to speak out. The problem is, this kind of fight escalated is exactly what the party doesn't need, so that I think the events of the week have pulled everybody back on both sides mm-hmm. of this fight, because they need to be pulled back from this edge, because, as I said earlier, people like Spanberger and like Presley really have to work together if they're going to make this thing work.
Well, Rochelle Riley, you've been waiting there patiently, and I'm very grateful for that. But respond to what you're hearing EJ say about the dynamics within the Democratic Party.
Well, again, I think that the Democratic Party is pretending like we're not in the age of Trump. They celebrated Nancy Pelosi's rise without acknowledging the stone ceiling that she hit in not having the Senate. So it doesn't matter if they pass 100 bills and nothing happens to them. And they're celebrating that all of these people, just like you want in America, have the ability to run for president, except you've got all these people running for president instead of just this once deciding, even though this isn't the typical American way, we need to unite as a party and find one person and get everybody behind them, because we have a president right now who is dangerous. He is literally overturning a century of progress in this country and taking us back to a time when W.E.B. Du Bois said that the problem of the next century would be the color line. And he's now making it the problem of this century.
Mm. Well, let's see if we can sneak.
Can I say, I just really strongly agree with this idea that Trump right now is the problem. And if I go back very briefly to the earlier very good conversation you had, if you look at our history, we make advances and then we go back. The best example is Reconstruction produced enormous gains for African Americans for a very brief period. There was a racist backlash. It was Reconstruction was ended and we had Jim Crow. Civil rights years were known, I think, correctly as the second Reconstruction, and the rise of Donald Trump reflects a second effort to push back on advances, incomplete advances. These advances have always been incomplete. Racism has persisted, but to push back on the advances we've made. And so I think the battle right now is first and foremost to prevent this, if you will, retrogression that we're seeing in the White House, and then find ways of moving forward again.
Right. Well, let's see if we can get at least one more call here before we run out of time. So let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comment. As someone from the Hispanic community, a lot of people who defend Donald Trump tend to be more from white descent. But I just want to say I don't see any racism in his comment whatsoever, mostly because there is no implication in his words of racial superiority. He's simply upset that someone, a group of people disagree with him. He's implying they were incompetent before, they're incompetent now, and therefore they shouldn't be making comment on how he does.
Well, so Andrew, hey, let me just ask you a quick question. You don't see any racism in the president, not just implying, but pretty much directly stating that he doesn't believe that several congresswomen serving the United States of America are American and they should go back to, quote, wherever they came from? I mean, how is that not racist?
Right. I don't, because there's no, in that statement that you just said, there is no implication of superiority is the key word here. Simply telling someone to go back where they came from isn't a comment on the actual people who live in the origin where they came from. He's only commenting on their what he believes to be their incompetency. I don't see it inherently racist to tell someone to go back to their country if they don't like it somewhere. There's no comment of, it'd be different if they go back to your country, your people are incapable of running their own country, your people are inferior to ours. Those are different statements than just go back to where you came from.
But he did say in the first of all, he was telling Americans to go back to their country when their country is the United States of America. And second of all, he also said that in those other countries that he was saying that they are terrible places. So he did imply superiority there. So is that not racist?
There could be terrible places for other reasons besides race. I don't think that implies that's his racial superiority. And just to give the benefit of the doubt for the sake of argument, we know 3 out of 4 of the people he's commenting about are American. Let's say they weren't, and they were from a different country. I still don't see it racist to tell someone to go back to where they came from.
Yeah.
If I have a friend from Boston to tell him to go back where he came from, as I hate Bostonians. You know, right. I just don't see it. I don't see it at all.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your... Yeah, I just want to say thanks to Andrew for his call. But also, all 4 of them are American. 3 of them are just native born. But EJ, we've got about 30 seconds to go. But go ahead.
Yeah, I just respectfully disagree with the gentleman. Go back to your country when 3 of them were born in the United States is a classic form of anti-immigrant racism. And secondly, saying that they hate their country is flatly wrong. And thirdly, as you underscored, to associate countries in the third world with crime and that whole list of things Trump did, if that's not an anti-Semitic, if that's not a racist trope, I don't know what is.
Well, E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post and professor of government at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. E.J., thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Rochelle Riley, director of arts and culture for the City of Detroit, columnist as well, who's covered race and politics in Detroit for 20 years. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Rochelle.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.